find five Russian women bear candles. It's a poem written about a picture in the Sunday Times magazine, back from ages ago, of Russian women bending over this table of tiny candles, masses of them. It's just about them and the look upon their faces as they're looking at these candles. I bear candles to the Lord, so fine. Gentle twigs of beeswax to light a moment. They hiss and cry thickly into the snow. My eyes room in the cold, haze the aura until all cocoons itself into a hasty escape from life. Let them run. Let them cry in sad standing before the beeswax host. Let all run into the artful snow, dissolve until just the lights remain floating somewhere. Until all that can be is the light, us in that light, crying to blur and hold it in our eyes. This sort of follows a great chunk of poetry that I wrote before. I got into a very earth motherish sort of way of writing, which was really annoying me. So that's the end of it. But it was an anger at myself, really, for being unable to write any other sort of poetry. But it was kind of annoyance trying to get away from it, then realising that maybe I did agree with it after all. Praying with my seed to the sky. I am standing, and in my hand, outstretched, I hold some earth. If I stand like this, hang waiting, the seed will grow which is planted there. It moves now as I speak. So if I wait, standing like some seven-league woman, yes, if I hang like this, my hand open to the sky, I will bear fruit, perhaps bear a tree to the sky, an aspen, an orient golden pomegranate in my hand. How will I water it, the seed swelling in this outstretched earth, unless with tears, gentle tears, hung swaying in some earth mother supplication pose? Yes, yes, this is what I am, praying with my seed to the sky. This is a poem written about somebody in New York who, about 3 o'clock in the morning, having sort of done the rounds of the nightclubs, comes back to his studio, puts himself a record on 3 o'clock in the morning and starts dancing. And it's about watching any type of art, really, sort of watching dance or anybody perform, in a sense. And that empathy that you may get with that person on the stage, which kind of lifts your own ability to create and to perform yourself. And once you've seen something like that, there's no way back for you. You've got to push on. Called Early Morning Dance Studio. Once you've seen someone fly, work himself through until all that he is beats soaring, beats the boards and shadows, fling in dark abandon, a dance to net out your limits. Once you've seen and thought that maybe it was you tight inside that glad skin, dancing with no. That it was you tapping that music across the air into the busy night with lights blinking their exuberant town morphs, a flinging interchange of life with light that you, he, makes open on the wheeling boards. Oh, once you've seen and cried for in the sheer abandon, those supplicating joyful arms don't stretch out further to pull you inside out, with ecstatic beat movement, a total leaping of you within being him. Oh, once you've seen and leapt, you can't. There is no room to fall. The final poem is really about, there's a church near where I live called Brixton Church. It's an old Saxon church. It's very, very beautiful, but it's very plain. And when you see it, rather than thinking of God and religion and angels, you think more of the men that built it, really. So really what this poem's about is an idea of the men in the actual building of that church and the angels queuing up to be put into the windows. It's about stained glass windows. It's also a kind of love poem because it's about just a delight in what human labour can achieve. It's called Stained Relics. Men built angels with suns blazing from hands lifted toward glass congregations, eyes lowing like beasts in the candlelight. Many years it had taken to let them down. The colours had bled, staining the church, where the times flew like doves and angels hovered, queuing for establishment. One spring, it was finished. The sky rang over a soaring eagle and the sun was manhandled into place. The angel saw and held his light like a baby. You raised it from dust, script of years from the ground, and I have touched the sun now, meeting awesome angels.
Okay, three poems. I started off with a poem which was Bird Image, and this is another poem which is it's a conversation piece about a magpie. There's a folklore belief that the magpie is a cursed bird, one, because it's a thief and a nuisance, two, because it was one of the birds that refused to go into mourning when Christ was crucified. It only put on half mourning, and so stayed forever black and white. I rather like magpie. Anyway, it's called Magpie. I'm feathering my nest, the magpie said. Don't call me thief. God gave me eyes to spot the best, the brightest and most brief. What I most prize, the magpie said, are little gleaming stones, a glint of sunlight on a globe of blood before it dries. He met my gaze. He cocked his head and winked conspiratorially. And then he drove his beak into my treasure trove. I cried and cursed him, little beast so cocksure and so confident. His cunning, like the coat he wore, proclaimed him outlaw from the band that mourned for Christ. To catch a thief, I plucked an opal from a ring, unlucky stones for some. Come, crazy magpie, have a feast. It tempted him. Reflectively, he looked at me. I knew his game. The crafty creature did not speak, but drew, as if indifferent, a long tail feather through his beak. I held the opal to the sky between my fingertips. Come, magpie, come. Will you not take, for friendship's sake, my little gift? Flew at my finger, bit it hard. The opal dropped, he plunged, I lunged. The opal rolled about a yard. Each looked at each and slowly grinned. Its name was Wisdom, but the game was hard. I'm feathering my nest, the magpie said. Don't call me thief. God gave me eyes to steal the best. I do not want your grief. The second poem is part of a sequence. Now, when we first met, we were part of a women's writing group. I don't know what happened, but one by one we all became pregnant. Starting with Helen. It was something in the water or probably the wine. Anyway, Helen wrote a birth sequence about her experience of pregnancy, and I listened to this with avid interest, but did it fine when I was pregnant. I didn't do anything like so well as she had done. And as the months went by, I chronicled their passing with a series of agonized cries of despair. and this one is a one awful thing about these poems is that the worst thing about being pregnant is that you can't smoke, and I smoke incessantly. So all the poems I wrote when I was pregnant were very short, sort of in between quick, crafty, and gasps. This is the fourth poem in the birth sequence, and it's called Sonnets on the Forming of the Sexual Organs, because in the fourth or fifth month, the baby decides on its future sex. So, Sonnets on the Forming of the Sexual Organs. And should you be a girl, I'd have you notice all the things that change, for you are their historian. I'd give you for the moon that's not worth crying for, though cry you will, a silver ball, A high, clairvoyant attitude wherein the past, or what we know of it, will never take fixed shape, but be as Mercury, a messenger. I'd have you see from time to time the harvesting of bitter-handed women hedged by fields who bound each broken stem into a summer sweetness. I'd have you study cost, the unprogressive, obscure earning of the widow's mite, its always fresh precocity. I'd have you look with hatred at what's handed down, at every well-deserved investiture. Though you stand dewy-eyed with gifts, I'd have you touch the dead cold core in all of them, and then give thanks. I'd have you always nude and always virginal, and should you be a girl, but if a boy, I'd offer you at birth your sister's coronation cup for contemplation at each unjust flood or funeral. And if a boy, I'd offer only trust that somewhere in the sticks and knives and scientific lust you'd find a finer form of symbol for all that I'd deprive you of if I could rewrite time and so unpin the stopwatch of the womb's divisiveness. And I'll finish with a poem called War Poets, and it's really... I tend to be interested in First World War poets. And this poem is written in one of those moments of despair which I'm sure everybody here has experienced when you turn on the wires or the television and it's yet another war, yet another battle, yet another series of deaths. And I thought how ironic it was that these First World War poets wrote their poetry in protest, thinking that that would stop war, thinking that people would read their poems and realise that war was terrible, yet in fact they became part of the mythology of war itself. And I dedicate War Poets to one of the First World War writers called Ivor Gurney, who, as you probably know, wasn't actually killed in the war, but he was so badly shell-shocked that he spent the remainder of his life in a lunatic asylum. And Ivor Gurney became, in his madness, tormented by the wireless. Felt that people were getting at him through the wireless, and that, in a sense, is the start of the poem. So many years and times within our hearing are those voices, within our minds, dug in our memories, that bleeding earth, cursing in stanza, choking in rhyme, pegging their griefs on irregular meter. More active than the generals, counting the bootless feet, the pale battalions, cutting their teeth on a shell of explosive diction. History in the making finds it hard, harder to ignore the sounding of those voices. Lest we forget, their share of pen and bone rifles the newspapers, discordantly universal. The war was ours, as history is ours, who made the actions you devour. But it was not the war to end all wars. The media is a mind on horses dragging corpses round its chariot. Interpretations first an arrow, then a tank, unstoppable. Thought flounders in the mud of France. In Flanders was a lost idea where injury and protest drowned like heroes. Recycling war it goes, bulldozing language till its craters start to build and fill, and grammars once again the dirt upon a uniform, upon a young boy's corpse. And death is what it's always been, a little coffin rhetoric, a sonnet form, hating the weapons that they worked with. What gets through can never be what was. All down the ages sound laments for that lost company, reformed battalions, the raw recruits, the young commanders and the old command. Clean shaven as the daisies on a new mown lawn, lie history's decoded messages. A century of digging to be done before the final corpse finds fitful burial. Lest we forget, like poisoned gas, their words invade the atmosphere we still must breathe. There's nothing empty left, not even countryside they loved, but it is cramped into the camps of our intelligence. Generations refugees, they stand like ghosts, lifting distressful hands as if to turn that wireless off, and reading crazily between the lines of our recall, strange execution of their own request.
This is a poem that I wrote a while after I saw a film called Not a Love Story, which is a film about pornography and the pornographic industry. And the film really sort of totally destroyed me. For about 3 days, I couldn't stop crying. And it had a very strong impact on me. It's called Not a Love Poem. Hip, hop, bummies away, light-hearted, skinned, fluffy innocence titillates page 3, sincerity, respectability. Flip-flop, nice pair, curved, sculptured, scalpeled, to acceptability, response ability. In epidemic proportions, we're smuttered against walls, we're pricked up, looked down, shown up, and shoved into boxes, cubicles. Next, please. They are yours and us. Chiseled, defined, unrecognizable. We'll reclaim ourselves. You cocked it up. And this next poem is, I'm in a poetry class with Helen, and she asked us to write a poem, a sort of autobiographical poem, as part of an exercise. This is what I came up with. And I started writing it. I noticed when I was writing it that I was in a red room. And I noticed that about three... I tend to like rooms that have quite a lot of red in it. But anyway... In my womb, red, warm, a sucked thumb, enclosed, I turn to watch my path umbilically spiraling behind me, leading precisely to this moment, this history, this time. The Colombian-toned godfather priest, armed, killed, watches cloven cinnamon, salsa. I am this 60s history in my cot. In my world, I watch the black and white quiver, in love, in hate. Insane I am to be the brown bridge that builds trust. My black, my white dissolve. A third language later, I come into the cold, from calypso warmth to learn. Tumbled around classes, contort to become ideologically sounding black and white. And red. In my space, mirrored, my face. Watch it slowly cocooning out, recognizing its sex, rediscovering its history, culture, strength, in women, loving life, the black, the white, the smiling birth. And the last poem I'll read is called Credo. I will home, only enveloped with sisters, aunts, cuddles, and comrades. Alone you want me, naked you want me, snaked and sexy you want me. You want comfort-filled arms, not the fight in me, is me, to you, right, who I enough. I will home, only alone, with confidence, with stature, without gift of casserole smiled. I will home, uncringing, pushed off the brink, loving my body, guilt hangs up by door, shapeless, naming the nameless fears, proud. I will come home. read three poems as well.
Is my bag down there behind you?
The kind of canvas.
This canvas. Never mind.
Excuse me a moment. As I say, you can all get some of your concentration from somewhere. There's an illustration, for example. Describe a poem. I want to start by reading a poem which is entitled Self Portrait, which is for Hannah Bramnes, who is the absent member of our group because she's in Oslo studying at the moment. When she was last over in England, she showed me a catalogue of an exhibition by Scandinavian women artists and asked me for my response. But since I can't read any of the Scandinavian languages that the catalogue was in, all I could do was respond to the paintings, which included a great many self-portraits and also a painting which was somewhat in a pre-Raphaelite mode, a kind of allegorical, symbolical picture of spring or la primavera. So that was one thing which fed into the poem. This coincided with reading some John Ashbery and realizing that there were other ways of writing poetry than the kind of composition by cutting that Tom Pickard taught us all to do a few years ago when he was a creative writing fellow here. So I just tried to write long lines and let it all in. And I was also trying to be fairly kind of discontinuous about it and just let my mind go where the language led me. And in the end, it turned out to be quite coherent after all. But the only other thing to tell you is that at the moment we have a temporary secretary in the English Department office who was sent a message from the bookshop that the copies of H.D. Thoreau's Walden had eventually arrived. And this message got converted into Sorrow was in the bookshop. And I pick up on that. I mean, I slightly change it again. So this is... I don't change Sorrow, but I change the actual kind of how it's used. So this is my self-portrait. Being a single parent mother with two young babies, the only time I get to write is about sort of sometime after 10:30. So maybe this is okay. I wrote it in the kind of state we're now all in. Self-portrait. She knows all about la primavera, the plucked blossom and the dangerous journey. She has travelled through death and is uncertain whether she has drunk from the well of oblivion or the well of memory. She stares in the deep pool of 60-watt light and sees herself, ragged cuticles, broken toenails, rough, bleached hands, tired, drained cheeks. She hears the rhythmic breathing of her children deep in sleep and listens for their nightmares, fears, and croup. She fingers different walls and knows their textures, acrylic, pure lamb's wool, man-made mohair. She can distinguish air-dried nappies from those dried artificially and knows which terries are 100% cotton and which are 50% viscose. She admires the grain on her desktop and contemplates the patterns of puke on the rug. So many poets recently have seemed to write about love, and it seems to her they all mean one thing, right of possession, the male right over the female. Is all male poetry based on topping? She has watched the sheep tupping, the rams clashing their horns and the deer rutting. She has seen the lubricious penis inserted, thrust, quiver and subside.
And it seems to her the teleology of masculine heterosexual desire is the wrath of the Cain before the first act. She knows all about spring, the gentle genes, the raised clitoris, the open cunt, the stretched lips and perineum, the quick cut, the curled nerves stitched back to grow in and in on itself, the ridge scar. The next cut is the deepest, but she sews the buttons back on, counts the stitches, weaves a cloth to hold a dance of life, and misses each little death. She plans broad sweeps of colour, many poppies and sweet peas, and exiles the deep-rooted, tall cooches' monocotyledonous proliferation, fights each invading blade of grass. At night, the light is gentle, sister moon, and brother electricity. Your glow is soothing, comforting, consoling, and companionable. And in a week, says the telephone message, I must lecture on sorrow, on H.D. Sorrow, who stayed 2 years by an unruffled pond. My children are sleeping, my cunt she ain't weeping, and the desk light pawns on this page. The last two poems I'm going to read. I've never read before or even tried out on anyone. I'm not quite sure whether they even work or not. But they're kind of fairly open field meditations on motherhood and from the maternal emotion, see what I mean? And again, they just feel appropriate to the time of the evening rather than do anything too tight. They were, I think, written the same day. Last summer, the 6th of August, and the first one is entitled Hiroshima Anniversary, which it was. Hiroshima Anniversary. The warmth of the foxy, the pedigree Siamese cat catches his first. The thrush flies up the flue to emerge later, wing damaged, broken. Soft golden honeybees mess with the lemon balm. 4 types of butterfly sip the buddleii, fair trees, and stretch their wings to the sun. Red admiral, ochre tortoiseshell, purple peacock, opal-eyed, delicate white frailties. My sons lie sleeping. Now is the time for work. Each poet so minute, each world so infinite. 2 ladybirds copulate. I, lesbian, deviate. In nature there is no ratiocination. Her soft belly accommodates. She is the mother who endlessly stillborn, aborted, lost in the 12th week, surviving an hour or so with hard, uninflatable lungs, or twin white butterflies hover over the lavender. She is the mother of infinite patience. I should reassure you, I'm not actually a lesbian. It was merely, as it were, the persona of the poem. And the illustration is this child's rag book, which I adore. I don't know if my kids do. And I adore it because it has these totally kind of disconnected images, and totally artificial as well, in terms of the colours that are chosen for, you know, sort of purple trees and things like that, and bright red toadstools, and I just love it. And I love that kind of sense of the vividness of, as well as seeing the natural world as, with the eyes of a child, and it's all being magic, and it's not having to be restricted to realism. So it's simply playing around with that. And again, it's very much about maternal emotion. A's first rag book. From time to time, we may love. On the kitchen floor, under the apple tree. The red ants chew the unfortunate worm. Bright primary toys, burnished blue leaves. Two weasel young gambol in the sun. The huge hedgehog eats earwigs and sups a saucer of milk by moonlight. Golden cypress, juniper horizontalis. Three sparrows on the fence. Chirrup, chirrup, chirrup. An apple falls from time to time. In the first few weeks we slept together. Your lips nuzzled my nipple, little butting head. We woke, drowsed, dreamt, and woke to change from teat to teat. White stars shined in the black sky. On the purple bough, a green-eyed owl. A white mouse nibbles large blackberries. My milk flows. We may love from time to time.
This is also a poem for Hannah. She and I went on a journey around America in 1981, visiting American women poets all over America. And we travelled by Greyhound bus, and this was a poem about the journey. It's called Gin and Grapefruit, which is what we survive for. Now these times at which we have centred our common knowledge, our uncommon energy, put together in one room, looking out over London, over New York, competing with the noise of buses, the noise of poetry, your struggle with language greater than mine. Later, the bitter grapefruit and the warm gin. These moments, I've looked over at you, tired and still looking at pictures, tired and still sitting alone, talking to strangers in a cafe, tired and still writing in notebooks, the conflict of sex with the need to write, sharpened as we cross the Rocky Mountains in a blizzard, longing for wine and cigarettes. I value our friendship as one that always keeps impulse for travel, This is a poem for another friend of mine called Rosemary, who I thought was going to be here tonight, and I'll read it for him. At the end of the day, night follows on. For Rosemary. Bright, raucous imaginings flit out over sea as feet skim sand. Strong voice echoes as horizon presses out and in. As early morning we have a conversation from the night. Talk round sharp edges of confused ritual. We stand in church as a marriage passes by. Could we be that close as hymns flash upwards? Could we speak a word to shatter instinct? Could we kneel down and whisper on the church tile, searching for meanings, when there is the sound of your known voice? Wine glints in a glass. Speed of light, speed of darkness. Hang on. Eyes dark in the sun. White pages deep in the night. Make us right. This one's called Origin. I can feel the precision of my heart beating under there through that thinness of skin and toughness of bone. It says two things to me. First, I'm still an animal and my blood will pulse and my heartbeat quicken at the first sign of danger or excitement. Second, I know that it will beat faster as a sign of love, of sensuality, of sex. Sometimes I hardly realize how much faster until I feel my breath forcing open my mouth and letting out a moan or a shout or an inarticulate sound that reminds me that I am still an animal and have nerves and skin and fur that respond to your touch. I don't care what they say. A woman alone on the underground at 10:30 at night is good.